Hello, listeners. Welcome to Stars of the Golden Age, a show that highlights the lives of legends from film, music, and the birth of television during Hollywood's Golden Age, with a special emphasis on their lives behind the scenes. I am your host, Erin Carlson. Hello, listeners. If I were to say the name William Pratt, would that mean anything to you? Likely no. How about the name Boris Karloff? Ah, now that sparks something, right? It's Frankenstein's monster himself. Today, in honor of Halloween, we will be talking about Boris Karloff, better known to those close to him as William Pratt. Speaking of Halloween, please stay tuned at the end of today's story to learn how you can listen to our special spooky Halloween bonus episode, all about haunted Hollywood. But it's only available on Patreon, where all of our fun bonus content lives. So stay tuned at the end to learn how you can hear about these Hollywood hauntings and so much more valuable Golden Age information. But for now, let's dive on in to the story of Frankenstein's monster, Boris Karloff. Boris Karloff was born in London as William Henry Pratt on November 23, 1887. His parents were Edward and Eliza, and little William wasn't their first child, or second, or third, or even fourth. He was their ninth child. Father Edward was half British and half Indian, and the family had lived in Bombay before William was born, as Edward worked for the Indian Customs Office. Edward was considerably older than Eliza, so he was 60 or 61 when Boris was born, and his mother was only in her late 30s. I'm going to refer to William by his stage name of Boris throughout this story, just so we don't get confused along the way. When Boris was about 2 years old, his parents separated. Edward was an extremely difficult man and was known to be controlling and abusive to his wife and children. Not just emotionally abusive, he was terribly abusive physically as well. Edward died 2 years after the separation, and Eliza fell into a deep depression and spent the rest of her life struggling with severe mental illness. From this point on, Boris was raised by his older siblings. He didn't share much about his childhood during his later life. There was a lot he simply didn't want people to know about his past during his lifetime. He was ashamed of the abuse, he was ashamed of his mother's mental illness, and he was ashamed of his Indian heritage. All of the Pratt sons were expected to have careers in civil service like their father had. He had ingrained this into their minds their entire lives. But he died when Boris was so young, so he never had the opportunity to instill this wish into his youngest son. Most of the Pratt boys honored their father's wishes for them, but Boris did not. "I didn't want to," he said. "I was a lazy little devil at school because I knew exactly what I wanted to do. Go on the stage. I wanted to be an actor." Boris's brother George felt a draw to the stage, too. He appeared in several local plays, but ultimately bowed out of the theater for a job in civil service. Boris did not grow out of it, though. He was determined. He didn't want to work for the government, or any other typical job for that matter. He wanted his work to be exclusively in the theater. His first taste of acting was in 1896, when he was 9 years old, when he played the Demon King in his school play of Cinderella. And he loved it. He was determined to be an actor, but he had one little obstacle. He had a stutter and a lisp. He worked his way through his childhood stutter, but the lisp was there to stay. He later made it an asset in his future career, not a barrier. He made his unique voice part of his appeal as an actor. Although he didn't want to have a government desk job, Boris's siblings who had raised him did really want him to follow that path in life. Remember, it was ingrained into their brains by their late father. So Boris went through the motions and attended King's College in London, for a while at least. When he turned 21 years old, however, things were going to change in his life. He was going to take the reins and steer his life in the direction he wanted for himself. The £150 inheritance he received when he turned 21 helped him do that. That £150 would be about £23,000 today, or about $30,000. With the financial boost he now had, he walked away from university and relocated to Canada, spending some time in Banff before settling in Vancouver, ready to pursue a career in the theater. Unfortunately, 1909 Vancouver didn't have the abundance of stage roles Boris thought they did, ready to just throw out roles to every new aspiring actor that showed up in town. In his mind, he thought he could just arrive in town and be immediately thrust into the bustling theater world. But reality, as it has a way of doing, told him otherwise. It wasn't going to be that easy. He would have to work his way up, put in the hard work. So instead, he took on what jobs he could, jobs outside of the theater world. He did construction work, he was a truck driver, he was a baggage handler for the railroad, he was a surveyor for the electric company, and he was a lumberjack. He worked hard. These were physically difficult jobs. But he wasn't about to give up on his dreams of being an actor. He was ready to put in the work and hold on to those dreams. In early 1910, Boris met fellow stage performer Grace Harding. They fell in love and got married pretty quickly. The following year, Boris's dreams of acting would finally begin to start showing some promise. He finally got his feet on the stage a little more. A small theater company called the Jean Russell Players cast him in a few small roles in 1911, and then he went on the road with the company. It was at this point that he started using the stage name of Boris Karloff. He admitted later that he was a horrible actor, in his eyes at least, and he knew exactly why he hadn't made his big break in those early days in Vancouver. He simply wasn't good, he said. He was a stumbly mess and he had a lot to learn. So that's what he did. He learned, he practiced, and he improved. Eventually, he was receiving wonderful reviews and was being cast as a leading man. The company toured all over Western Canada and the northern states of the Western U.S. He continued to hold down regular jobs too when not traveling with the theater company, mostly very labor-intensive, and he just kept holding on tightly to his dreams. These physically demanding jobs he held during this time would leave Boris Karloff with lifelong back problems. So bad, he would be in constant pain and would require multiple back surgeries down the road. Boris and Grace's love wasn't meant to be. They divorced in 1913, just 3 years after getting married. Marriage didn't seem to be Boris Karloff's strong suit. He would be married a total of 6 times. He married his second wife, Olive, in 1916, and they too were only married for 3 years. Rumor has it that Boris had a difficult time being faithful to his wives, and further rumors state that he may have even had children with one or two of these women. Again, these are rumors. If true, I'm sure that kind of extracurricular activity did not help his marriages and likely contributed greatly to them being so short-lived. In 1918, while still married to Olive, wife number two, Boris had landed himself in California, along with droves of other aspiring actors flooding into the state. And before long, he also landed in silent films. He recalled his first movie role being an extra part in which he was paid $5. That would be $107 today. His earliest film that still survives today was The Masked Rider in 1919. He was just an extra in that film, too. He continued to appear in bit parts of silent films, working steadily in these extra roles, as well as some stage work and more manual labor jobs to pay the bills. Boris Karloff's first substantial role was in 1920's The Deadlier Sex. It wasn't until 1931, 13 years after arriving in L.A., that his dedication to making it as an actor finally started to pay off. That year, he landed a supporting role in a movie called The Criminal Code, with Walter Huston and Constance Cummings. During this initial 13-year period in California, he'd also gone through a divorce with his second wife, plus gotten married and divorced two more times. By 1928, he was 40 years old, and he had four marriages and four divorces under his belt. In 1930, he married his fifth wife, and this marriage actually lasted more than the few years that the previous ones had. Her name was Dorothy, a librarian, and together, about 8 years into their marriage, they had a daughter named Sarah in November of 1938. On Boris's actual birthday, they shared a birthday. Sarah was born on her father's 51st birthday. Backing up a little bit from the birth of Sarah, let's rewind to when Boris Karloff was 44 years old in 1931. This was the most significant year of his career. First, that prominent role in The Criminal Code. This was also the year that he was approached in the Universal Studios commissary and asked if he would like to play the monster in the upcoming film rendition of Mary Shelley's novel, Frankenstein. Boris Karloff's natural look was perfect for Frankenstein's monster. His facial structure made makeup artist Jack Pierce's job a much easier task. I'm not saying it was a simple task making up the monster of Frankenstein every day, but he had a good palette to work with. Karloff wore dentures, so to portray a more sunken look in his face, those were removed during shooting. The monster didn't speak, so this did not affect filming at all. It only helped it. Bela Lugosi was originally asked to take the role of the monster in Frankenstein. He had had great success as Dracula earlier that year, and Universal wanted to capitalize on that success and put him in their next horror film, Frankenstein. But Bela Lugosi didn't like the fact that there was no dialogue in Frankenstein. He also didn't like that his appearance would be completely covered up with makeup. So, without the audience recognition of his face or voice, he wasn't interested. This worked out really well for Boris Karloff. Boris Karloff and Bela Lugosi would end up working together later on. They appeared in eight films together between 1934 and 1945. All of them horror movies, of course.
What is art without the muse? Many of Western art's most famous works are depictions of women. But who were these women? Do they have their own stories to share with the world? Hi, listeners! Grace Anna here, host of Art Muse, a podcast that shares the life stories of the women pictured in famous works of art. In doing so, Art Muse aims to reshape the ways in which we interpret these well-known works by paying dues to the women whose images have been immortalized, but whose names and stories have been wrongfully overlooked. Each episode focuses our attention on a specific female muse, sharing their important life and legacy. By sharing these women's stories, we are given the opportunity to appreciate artworks from a new perspective, through the eyes of the women whose image stares back at us. Season 3 continues to share the life stories of the women pictured in famous works of art, this time focusing on artist models who were also performers in their own right. Season 3 will begin its release this fall. We cannot wait to share these amazing women's stories with you. In the meantime, we hope you continue to enjoy Season 1 and 2 of Art Muse, available on all streaming platforms. Until next time, bye for now.
Frankenstein was a great success in 1931, and it was finally the project that made Hollywood and moviegoers take notice of Boris Karloff. After playing bit parts in over 80 movies, Boris Karloff was finally working as a true actor in substantial roles. He was so well received as Frankenstein's monster that he was immediately settled into the horror genre. The Mummy, The Ghoul, The Black Cat, Bride of Frankenstein, The Son of Frankenstein, The Raven, The Black Room, The Walking Dead. Boris did some films outside of the horror genre, but horror was what he was known for, and horror is what made him a famous and wealthy man. While some actors may not like being typecast like this and may feel like they're stuck in a certain type of role, Boris Karloff didn't mind one bit. He said, quote, "Certainly I was typed, but what is typing? It is a trademark, a means by which the public recognizes you. Actors work all their lives to achieve that. I got mine with just one picture. What a blessing," end quote. He found the thing that worked for him, and he was happy to stay there. I want to talk a little about 1931's Frankenstein before we move on with his life. Boris Karloff and director James Whale did not get along very well. And possibly as a result of this contention, Boris Karloff was not invited to any of the publicity events promoting the movie. Whale also worked him very hard, making him do several retakes of very physically difficult scenes. I also want to circle back to the makeup and talk a little more about the makeup required for the character of Frankenstein's monster. Like I said earlier, it was makeup artist Jack Pierce who transformed Boris Karloff into the monster of Frankenstein every day of filming. But before that could happen, they needed to figure out what the monster looked like. Director James Whale and some of the artists at Universal Studio drew up several sketches of the proposed monster of Frankenstein. And the iconic beast we know today is what they landed on. I'll post a photo of some of the early concept sketches of proposed monster images. I think what they went with was the perfect choice. Both director James Whale and makeup artist Jack Pierce agreed that they wanted to use Boris Karloff's natural bone structure as the base for the monster. So they started there. There was a certain sinister eeriness to Karloff's face, and they wanted to maintain some kind of human quality to the monster. A, quote, "pitiful humanity." Jack Pierce and Boris Karloff put in overtime in the makeup department for 3 weeks of trials and errors to accomplish the perfect look for the monster before filming was to begin. Their hard work paid off because they achieved the perfect monster of Frankenstein. Here's what was required to create the monster. First, the top of his head and that distinctive protruding eyebrow ridge. These features were created by using spirit gum adhesive to adhere cotton to Karloff's natural eyebrow ridge and the top of his head, and then painted over with the alcohol-based collodion liquid plastic. This process was layered on until the final result was achieved. The top of the head took a lot. Here's what Jack Pierce had to say about the decision to create the head as they did. Quote, "I spent 3 months of research in anatomy, surgery, medicine, criminal history, criminology, ancient and modern burial customs, and electrodynamics. My anatomical studies taught me that there are 6 ways a surgeon can cut the skull in order to take out or put in a brain. I figured that Frankenstein, who was a scientist but no practicing surgeon, would take the simplest surgical way. He would cut the top of the skull off straight across like a pot lid, hinge it, pop that brain in, and then clamp it on tight. That is the reason I decided to make the monster's head square and flat like a shoebox, and dig that big scar across his forehead with the metal clamps holding it together. End quote. The large scar on the monster's forehead was created by soaking cotton and cheesecloth in collodion and then adhered to the face. He had similar scars created on his arms this way too. As I mentioned, Karloff wore dentures, so those were removed for filming to make his face appear more sunken. There are some sources that say wire clamps were used inside of his mouth to pull his lips and create a more stiffened look. Once the face was complete, they decided the eyes still looked a bit too human. To counter this, Pierce created the droopy eyelids on the monster using either a special makeup putty or mortician's wax. With all of this cotton, glue, and wax added to Karloff's face, it was then all covered up with greenish-gray grease paint. Boris Karloff recalled the facial makeup being very uncomfortable and sometimes quite painful, especially that putty on his eyelids. And then those trademark bolts in his neck. Those were actual old-timey electrodes that were applied to his neck using more spirit gum adhesive. Removing them every night was painful, and Boris Karloff was left with permanent scars on his neck as a result of the process. Finally, Karloff's fingers were colored dark with black shoe polish. The process of transforming Boris Karloff into Frankenstein's monster took between 3 and 3.5 hours every morning. Morning may be a stretch. Karloff plopped his butt down in Jack Pierce's makeup chair at 3:30 a.m. every day. Boris then spent the next 10-plus hours filming, which was also often very grueling, before having to sit down in the makeup chair again to have all the makeup, cotton, glue, and electrodes removed, before doing it all over again the next day. The makeup removal process took about 1.5 hours each night. I can't imagine the nightmare that caused to his skin. No, thank you. Sometimes Karloff wanted to save himself from the time and pain, so he slept in the makeup, propping up books on the sides of his head to ensure that he would lay still all night and not mess up his makeup. Imagine waking up next to that. Moving on now to the monster's clothing. His sleeves were cut short to create the illusion of him being large, to make his arms look longer. As for his body, Boris Karloff was 5'10 or 5'11, but the Frankenstein monster was 6'6. To create this height, Karloff had to wear lifted boots, and they were not comfortable. Each boot weighed 13 pounds. Then, steel rods were attached to Karloff's legs under his pants to create that lumbering movement that the monster had when he walked. The entire costume weighed almost 50 pounds. Between the difficulty of eating while made up all day and the workout from the extra weight that he carried around as part of his costume, Karloff lost 20 or 25 pounds during the shooting of Frankenstein. Production lasted for 40 days. So, Frankenstein was a huge hit, and it went down in history as one of the most iconic horror films of all time. And the character of the monster is undoubtedly one of the most famous and most recognizable monsters ever created. Although he is widely referred to as Frankenstein, that isn't really his name. He doesn't really have a name. Dr. Frankenstein was the scientist who created the monster. After his role as the monster, Boris Karloff stayed busy starring in highly successful horror films for the next few years. The horror genre faded out a bit by the mid-1930s, mostly due to the party poopers over at the production code office. There were a lot of censorship cuts in horror films, so studios kind of backed away from them a little until censors loosened up down the road. In 1938, Boris Karloff starred in the first of 5 films in the Mr. Wong detective series. He played a Chinese man. Not for the first time, even. He did so alongside Myrna Loy in The Mask of Fu Manchu in 1932 as well. This was seen as perfectly normal casting in that day. Maybe not by the Chinese, but by American film producers. Of course, looking back at these types of movies, we see them as very problematic through today's lens. In 1941, the highly successful play Arsenic and Old Lace opened on Broadway, and then immediately turned out onto the silver screen with Cary Grant. When casting for the play, there's a line in the script that is said by the criminal who'd undergone botched cosmetic surgeries, and he says to his surgeon, "He said I looked like Boris Karloff. You did this to me," in reference to his Frankenstein-esque look. So producers thought, as they were casting for the play, why don't we try to actually get Boris Karloff? And they did. Boris Karloff was heading to Broadway, a dream come true. When production began on the film version of Arsenic and Old Lace, producers wouldn't allow all of the actors to break away from the still-running Broadway show to shoot the film. So Karloff was ordered to stay on the stage and didn't make it into the film version. He did, however, revise his role as Jonathan Brewster on television in 1951 on the Ford Theater Hour, and again in the TV movie remake in 1962. Although Boris Karloff had begun his acting career on the stage, he had never performed on Broadway until Arsenic and Old Lace in the early 1940s. The decade of the 1950s, however, would see him as a great Broadway star. He had originally been terrified to perform on Broadway in Arsenic and Old Lace, but his highly praised reception had boosted the confidence he needed to perform further on Broadway. Horror films from the 1930s and 1940s also went through a renaissance during the late 1950s and early 1960s, bringing names like Boris Karloff and Bela Lugosi to the forefront for a new generation of audiences. Boris stayed busy appearing on variety shows, and he hosted and performed in the horror anthology series Thriller from 1960 to 1962. In 1957, at the age of 69, Boris Karloff was diagnosed with emphysema. Although he struggled living with the disease, he continued to work. He did the Thriller series, he did movies, he did plays, and he did TV. His role that held on the tightest from this period of his career never showed his face, though. But we've all seen it. It was How the Grinch Stole Christmas in 1966. Boris Karloff was the voice of the original Grinch. He did a bunch of other voice work too, as well as lending his trademark voice to various radio projects. Boris and his fifth wife, Dorothy, had divorced in 1946 after 16 years of marriage. Not long after their divorce, he married wife number six, who he would remain married to for the rest of his life, a woman named Evelyn. They were married for 23 years. In 1959, Boris and Evelyn returned to Britain, which would become their primary residence. Boris's health was increasingly making life difficult for him, but he still returned to the States to do film projects. He required oxygen most of the time, and his severe back problems had him in a wheelchair much of the time, too. But when he did film or television projects, he would use all the strength he had to perform apart from the oxygen and wheelchair. They were never in sight when the cameras were rolling. He was tough, and he was determined to keep working as long as he possibly could. In late 1968, an already weakened Boris Karloff developed bronchitis. He was hospitalized and he never recovered. Boris Karloff, known to his loved ones as William Pratt, passed away on February 2, 1969. He was 81 years old. And now I would like to share some other things I learned during my research. Bullet point number one. Boris's mother, Eliza's aunt, so Boris's great-aunt, was Anna Leonowens. She was the governess and teacher to the Siamese King Mungkut, and her published memoirs of her experiences in that position later inspired the novel Anna and the King of Siam, and the Rodgers and Hammerstein play The King and I. Bullet point number two. 1931's Frankenstein was banned in Ireland until 1965 for being, quote, demoralizing and unsuitable for children or nervous people, end quote. It was banned in China as well and probably other places. Bullet point number three. Boris Karloff was a founding member of the Screen Actors Guild. He was the ninth member to join in 1933. He served as a board member and officer from the Guild's creation in 1933 through 1949. Bullet point number four. Boris Karloff kept an apartment at the famous Dakota in New York. In conclusion, Boris Karloff was a great star in the horror genre of old Hollywood. He was in his 40s before he saw fame in Frankenstein, but he worked incredibly hard to get to that point. While many actors may feel stuck in the typecasting Boris Karloff found himself in, he embraced it. He was grateful for the success Frankenstein gave him, and he was happy to stay in the genre that had given him that success. But the man behind Boris Karloff, the man behind the monster of Frankenstein, was not a frightful monster. William Pratt was a kind and gentle man. He was a private man. He loved to lose himself in books, and he loved to spend time engaging with friends. He loved his daughter more than anything in the world and was wonderful with children. His physical appearance and his unique brand of talent may have made him the perfect monster, but William Pratt himself was a warm and thoughtful man. Thank you, Boris Karloff, for listening to your soul and following the path you wanted for yourself, not falling into the life others wanted for you. Thank you, like so many others in our stories, for showing us that hard work truly does pay off if you're willing to put in the time and effort. And thank you all for listening. Now, I would like to cordially invite you to the Stars of the Golden Age Patreon community. Do you want to learn about the history of movie theaters? I got you covered. How about stories of some old-time movie set disasters? I got what you're looking for. Or Black history in Hollywood? The behind-the-scenes history of the Hollywood casting couch? Old Hollywood studio rules? I have all of that for you. Those are just a few of the bonus episodes I have over on Patreon for members there. This month, I talk about alleged haunted places in Hollywood. Places that were hopping in the Golden Age and seem to still hold some Golden Age spirits today. It doesn't stop at bonus episodes, though. We enjoy old movies together, too. And each month, I will share with you my recap of that month's movie, along with some fun info about them, too. We've done The Great Ziegfeld, Mrs. Miniver, Summerstock, Arsenic and Old Lace, and lots more. This month's movie is Blythe Spirit, in the spirit of Halloween. But wait, there's more! The most fun segment over on Patreon is definitely The Cocktail Party. With that, I share a vintage cocktail recipe, along with the history of that drink. And then I dive into my collection of old movie magazines from the 30s, 40s, and 50s, and I read you some juicy, vintage celebrity gossip. It's tons of fun. So let me recap that for you. Each month, you can have a bonus episode that is guaranteed to cover an interesting topic, a topic that will make you smarter, and a movie of the month recap episode, and a cocktail party episode. I don't know why you wouldn't want all of that. It can be all yours for the low, low price of $8 per month, plus the entire backlog of bonus content. If $8 is a little too steep for your wallet, you can get just the Movie of the Month episode and the Cocktail Party episode for $4 a month. But I'm telling you, those full-length bonus episodes contain some pretty interesting stuff. And I'll send you a beautiful Stars of the Golden Age sticker and a shout-out on the podcast. But best of all, you are saying thanks to this little indie podcast and supporting the production of the show in a little way. Because I'm telling you, it is a ton of work to put out these episodes each week, between my research, writing, recording, editing, and promotion. I'll be honest with you, it's way more time-consuming than I imagined it would be, but I'm loving it. But loving it or not, I sacrifice a lot of time and money to do it, so a little thank you is very much appreciated. And I'm not even asking for handouts. I'm offering you some pretty sweet bonus content as a thank you for your support. Support your favorite little indie podcasts, I do, and support your local small businesses. In a world being taken over by AI and huge online marketplaces, let's keep the little guys afloat who are busting their butts to make a quality product. Let's support actual creative work created by actual human minds. Keep creativity and hard work alive. Patreon.com/Stars of the Golden Age Podcast. There is a link in the show notes that will take you right there. And a reminder for Apple users, if you sign up using a browser, not the app, you will save some money from those hefty Apple fees. But then, after you're signed up, you can use the app as usual. Thanks, guys. Reach for the positive in every day. Be kind to everyone you encounter, and have a great rest of your week. My primary source for this episode was a book titled Boris Karloff, The Biography by Brian Schell. I also used a documentary titled Boris Karloff, The Man Behind the Monster by Thomas Hamilton and Ron McCloskey. An article on the Monsters of Makeup website by Luke Munson from November 12, 2020 at monstersofmakeup.com and IMDb.